So I just tabulated our numbers like this morning from this last year growing. I grew over 3,000 pounds.
That's
And
amazing.
it's literally just the two of us. So there's only so much food two individuals can eat.
If you look at your pictures, on Instagram, it's mind-blowing how much stuff you are fitting into that 1400 square feet.
That is Meg Leah, a modern homesteader in Northwest Wisconsin who grows food for her family, friends, and her community in her fox and hound garden. With her partner, a backhoe, and a dream in 2019, she turned a grassy lawn into what is now 1,400 square feet of healthy, productive gardens. Lots of patience, overambitious dreams, and failing forward helped her grow into the successful gardener she is now. Today on Just Grow Something, Meg and I talk all things gardening and gardening for community. If you've ever thought that even just a little bit extra from your garden wouldn't be worth dropping off at the food pantry, Meg and I beg to differ. We talk planning, preserving, sharing the harvest, big flashy tomatoes, and dogs in the garden. We also talk about the time commitment needed to grow such a big garden and huge harvest in a short season area, which is less than what you might think. And the one must-have tool that Meg uses that has cut her weeding time by 75%, which of course means it's now on my wish list. Let's dig in. Hey, I'm Karen. I started gardening in a small corner of my suburban backyard, and now 18 years later, I've got a degree in horticulture and operate a 40-acre market farm. I believe there is power in food and that everyone should know how to grow at least a little bit of their own. On this podcast, I share evidence-based techniques to help you plant, grow, harvest, and store all your family's favorites. Consider me your friend in the garden. So grab your garden journal and a cup of coffee and get ready to just grow something. PlanterBox Direct has some exciting news to share. They've got a new shape and a new look. Now, not only can you get my favorite planters in square, rectangular, tiered, and stand versions, you've got a hexagonal option too. And on top of the 21 color choices they already offered, they've added rough cedar gray as a wood grain option on all shapes of their USA-made steel planters. Get your own long-lasting, beautiful planter boxes by going to planterboxdirect.com and using code JUSTGROW10 at checkout to save 10% and get free shipping. They're the planters I use in my own gardens, and now you can have them in yours in whatever color and shape combo you like. Use code JUSTGROW10 for 10% off and free shipping at planterboxdirect.com. There's one thing I talk about more than the benefits of mulch in the garden. It's the benefits of keeping a garden journal. Now, I'm old school, and I do things with a notebook and a pencil, but Meg's got a digital data guy on her side to help her keep track of how things are going in the garden, which means she can really dial in what's working and what's not.
So my husband's like a super nerd when it comes to like calculating things. He likes to see production. So is this plant actually producing? Is it doing what it's supposed to be doing? Or is it just kind of a lazy hangouter that we could get rid of? We could try something different. So we started calculating numbers when I actually started being successful at gardening. So like 2021, I'd say we started counting to see how we did. And it's helped me in like variety choice. Then I
Yeah.
know what I like, what I don't like. And then it gives us a rough idea of how much are we keeping? And then everything else gets donated. It gets given to friends, family. I mean, I ding dong ditch stuff. It goes everywhere. But there's very little that, I mean, we keep what'll keep us fed for a year, and then the rest all goes to people that'll use it.
Have you ever really tracked how much you and your family eat in a year by weight? Think about that for a hot second. It's Meg and her husband, two adults, growing 3,000 pounds of fresh produce. They're keeping what they'll eat in a year and giving away the rest. How much do you think that is? How much produce do you think you and your family would need to produce to keep you fed, fresh and preserved, for a year? Do you have a number in mind? Let's see what Meg says. Of that 3,000 pounds, how much stays home and how much gets gifted?
I'd say less than a third of it we keep. So one of my huge garden goals is to try and save what will feed us for a year. and to like, or at least until I get lettuce out of the garden again. So what we can hold on to. So I've got a wall of like pumpkins and squash and that kind of a thing. So I keep roughly one pumpkin or squash variety for each month. So in that way, I know I've got that to use that month for meal planning. I keep two big boxes of onions. I've got probably a half a fridge of carrots. I've preserved a ridiculous amount of tomatoes, some peppers, but then yeah, basically everything else, what we don't eat or I don't cook for people, it all goes to everyone else. So I'd say we probably about a third we hold on to, and then the rest goes elsewhere.
So Meg says, oh, probably less than a third. Like, that's not much, but that's 1,000 pounds. Even if she weren't giving away so much, that's a great yield for a family of two and something to aspire to for sure. But that kind of yield definitely takes some planning. Another favorite thing of mine, the garden plan.
So I like to kind of come up with a list of what are my must-haves, things that I know produce really well in the garden, stuff that we love to eat. I ask all friends and family, I'm like, hey, I'm planting the garden. What are some things you'd like? Somebody said eggplant. I'm like, you know, I've never grown it. I don't really eat it, but pan squash is just as good. Sorry, we're going to do that instead. But then after that, I go to my husband. So he's really into all things computers, CAD drawing, and he draws out my garden on a system where it is by like measurements. I don't do measurements. I'm a throw it and let's see what grows kind of gal. He's a let's measure things out so everything has a proper spacing. And we look at how many plants of what variety I can start here, or if I have to go get starts, what I need to get. And then we kind of mix from there and come up with what the plan is going to be every year. And it's a fun process. It's nice to sit down and go through it. And every time he asks me, what's the spacing on this? I'm like, Lord, if I know, hold on, let me get out the seed pack, read on the back. It takes a little bit, but we end up coming up with a really good idea, and I stick to it for the most part. Every now and again, I get a little overplanty, but that's how we plan it out every year.
There's nothing wrong with getting overplanty, and your husband is like my kindred spirit. I am a draw it out, have it measured, plan it out each succession. Like,
exactly.
I'm not a willy-nilly kind of person. So, yeah, that's.
Oh, I'm willy-nilly. Flowers everywhere. Throw in some herbs. And then, of course, I end up with powdery mildew, and I have to look at myself and go, well,
you did it to yourself
a little bit better. Exactly. Hey,
there's nothing wrong with trying to zhuzh things in as tightly as you possibly can and then figuring out later, like, well, maybe I ought to thin this out just a little bit. I'd rather have too much than not enough.
One of the things I talk about with new gardeners is how to plan what it is they want to grow. And part of that is deciding what will be eaten fresh and what will be stored. Now, not everybody wants to can or freeze or dehydrate, and that's okay. If you just want the garden for fresh produce to be used right away, then that's how you plan. But if you want to store enough for the off season, especially when you're in a short season growing area like Meg, then you have to think about what stores well and how you plan to use it. That helps dictate how you plan.
Last year, my focus in the garden was storables. So we grew a lot of different varieties of pumpkins and winter squash, onions, and lots of tomatoes, stuff that I know I can and stuff I know we're going to use. So I have not been able to figure out how to can pickles to save my life. So the cukes were strictly fresh eating and relish. But otherwise, I focus on planning what varieties I know go well in a sauce, stuff that I can put together, let it cook down in a roaster pan, or can tuck away in the basement. We have like a grocery store in the basement. It's quite wonderful, of just different canned goods and boxes of onions. But I plan based off of what I know we're going to eat. That's the easiest way to start a garden. If we're not going to eat it, like radishes. I love them. I think they're stunning, but do I like the taste of them? No. Does my husband? No. Our dogs? Nope. So I should really stop putting some of those in, but I always do. They're just so cute. Can't help myself.
So obviously, Meg didn't get to the point overnight where she can grow something and keep it in her garden plan just because it's cute, even though it's something they don't eat, like radishes. Meg's garden journey started in 2019, but she said they didn't even start tracking until 2021 when she says she got sort of good at it. And her learning journey was, and still is, what she calls failing forward.
Well, the first garden was... oh, what's the best way to phrase this? I had the funniest looking cucumbers you've probably ever seen. You know, the the under-pollinated ones, the ones that are big on one end and tiny on the other. And they were the best dang cucumbers, I will tell anyone, but nobody else agreed with me. And it was a learning experience. I'd only grown in pots before. I'd grown some herbs here and there, but this was the first time I had space. And I had weeds everywhere. It was epic and tiny. But then the second year, I'd got myself into, the, you know, those seed swaps online? Those, I can't do those anymore. I did a one and done year. I planted probably 90 varieties of things my second year because I thought I could grow it all. Oh, Lord, Karen, that was an epic mistake. It was a good learning experience, but it showed me that I was too big for my britches and I needed to rein it in. And my husband kindly said, I think this next year we either need to rein it in and do 15 varieties of things. And doesn't matter. Tomatoes is not one option. You've got to pick a variety of tomatoes. Do 15 things, do them well, and you can add to them every year. But let's be successful on a smaller scale, and then we can get bigger. So I fail forward. Every year I look at where I was successful. I look at where I had to learn more things. I didn't have bugs my first 2 years. I didn't have any pests. And then suddenly they found me. And then I'm like, what are you that's destroying my potatoes? Oh, those dang potato beetles, I tell you. But thankfully, my husband is so, so kind. I will catch a bug. I will bring it up to him and he will sit on the computer and look at what it is, go through all the, you know, pages on Google of bugs. Ooh, no, thank you. But he will figure out what it is and help me. So that way that little creature is not going to ruin my garden and I can keep the ones around that. I mean, I didn't know what a ladybug larva looked like. And at first I was like, you guys look weird. What is growing? Then I realized, nope. Those are good guys. Keep them on my peppers. You can hang out. But every year I learn, I grow, I fail forward. I've reined myself in, kind of, but I've gotten successful at it. So that's been helpful.
I think that experience of not having bugs, I mean, the weed pressure, yeah, I mean, depending on, you know, how you're growing or where you're growing, absolutely. But that experience of not having something happened the first 2 years, like the insect pressure. And then all of a sudden the third, it's always that third year that something starts to like rear its ugly head and you go, what the heck just happened here? I thought I was gardener of the year and wondered,
why was my trophy? And now,
you know, why does everybody think this is so hard? And you get to that third year and you go, oh, now I get it.
Oh, I get it. Look, I thought I could hand water my garden. I was like, oh, I got this. I'm going to hand water every day. It's going to be so romantic like you see in movies. And the next thing you know, I'm a week in and my husband's ordering drip tape.
Yeah, because how many hours were you out there trying to water things and they weren't getting soaked in? Oh, yeah.
No, because the amount of water that I could put down versus what they actually needed.
That experience of not having bugs or even weed pressure for the first 2 years, and then suddenly that third year, things start popping up like crazy, seems to be a common theme for new gardeners. It hit me, and it's hit just about every gardener I've ever spoken to. But what Meg said is true. Starting small and working your way up by adding one or two new things every year is a really good way to expand the garden. I still do that. I'm constantly tweaking what I'm growing, what varieties I plant, what new things I can try, but I've learned not to go overboard. I introduce things gradually, but planting just a few at a time to be able to tweak the system a little bit before I go whole hog the next year. Of course, that's just part of the challenge in gardening. Depending on where you live, the amount of time you have available to you for gardening can be another challenge.
You're in zone 4B. What are the challenges that you, I mean, obviously other than the weeds and the insects, but like, you know, weather-wise, temperature-wise, what are some of the challenges that you face? Because you obviously have a much shorter growing season than a lot of us do.
We do. We can start planting in the garden, kind of risky, Memorial weekend. But usually June, the start of June is when everyone's like, yep, we can get in the ground. And by mid-September, we'll get a frost in September. And some seasons have come to a halting end at the start of September. This last season, we were into mid-October before we did garden cleanup. So we can, it kind of depends on the year. And some seasons we've had rain, but the last three we've had a drought. Mm-hmm. So the pressures there kind of put a damper on some of the things, but it also helps with like weed pressure. There's not as much water getting put down everywhere else except where I want it. So that can be a benefit, but the cold, that's our biggest thing. We have a little microclimate down in the garden. And so every now and again, that little area is much cooler than the rest on the property. It's lower. So it can get frost sooner, which is such a bummer when you watch all these beautiful things that have been producing for you. And then next thing you know, it just abruptly comes to an end. Yeah.
I can't imagine having to wait until June and then you have to slam everything all in the ground all at once in order to be able to get it in and then be done by.
And then it all comes at once too.
Right. Yeah. You guys, you know, can't do as much in the way of like succession planting. And maybe with the cooler shoulder season stuff, I can imagine you can, but as far as your summer stuff, it's like a one and done, I'm guessing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. It starts rolling in mid to end of July. Tomatoes hit in August. And then you have just that short amount of time into September and then it's done.
I am super happy to announce that the merch shop over on justgrowsomethingpodcast.com has finally reopened. If you're looking for a great way to support the show while also sporting some cool garden-related clothing, mugs, and more, that's the place to do it. I'm adding more designs every few weeks, and I just know there is something over there that will fit right into your gardening personality. Head to justgrowsomethingpodcast.com/shop to check out all the options and support the podcast with specially designed merch from the show. justgrowsomethingpodcast.com/shop. One of the things Meg and I discovered that we have in common is that we've both relied on food pantries at one point or another to feed our families. Maybe that's part of the reason we are both so passionate about feeding people. When you've been in a situation where you've had to rely on the generosity of others, it means that much more to you to be generous when you're on the other end.
There was a period in our lives where our food came from a pantry, and I, you know, hurt my pride. But we needed to eat too. And I went, I grabbed what we needed, and I want to be able to give back to people because I knew when we were in need, people gave to us. I want to make sure if somebody else is in that same situation that they have a variety of very tasty things, healthy things, whatever they're looking for, that they don't have to go without.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We used to line up at the giveaway for harvesters and they would, you know, just throw whatever they had available into the back of your car. Like here, okay, this is what we have this month. And, you know, it may have not been stuff that we were used to eating, but we figured out a way to use it. Like I didn't know what to do with a cabbage, you know? So well, there was a bunch of cabbage that month. So I figured out what to do with cabbage, you know? And that's what we do now too, is, you know, we've got the different food, you know, pantries around here, and the one that's just here in our little town, they generally don't have anything that's fresh, even during the growing season. Mm-hmm. They get some of the leftovers from like the harvesters giveaways, but you know, it's mostly, you know, canned, boxed, whatever. And you're happy, you know, obviously to have whatever you can at that point, but having something fresh to go with it. I mean, just watching people, cause I go in and drop it off while they like, right as soon as they open, cause they're only open like twice a month, 2 weeks out of the month. And so I'll go in first thing on that Monday morning and people already lined up to get in. So I'm walking past them with these trays or boxes of fresh stuff and their eyes just go, oh, you know, like, oh, we get something like other than a box or a can today, which that makes it worth it for sure.
Exactly.
In the United States in 2022, which are the most recent numbers we have, 12.8% of households were food insecure. This means at times during the year, these households were uncertain of having or unable to acquire enough food to meet the needs of all their members because they had insufficient money or other resources for food. That 12.8% translates into 17 million people, a large percentage of whom are over the age of 65 and living alone.
I live in an elderly community, so a lot of the people that go to the pantry are people who are probably in their 70s. And knowing that they've got what they need and they love seeing the different things, like bringing in pan squash. The people that were working at the pantry, they're like, I have no idea what this is. But of course, the people that are there to get it are like, oh, my so-and-so used to grow this. We called it patty pan squash.
Yes, or that's what we still call it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And it warms my heart that people get exactly what they need and what they can use. We have a local food pantry, a kind of a circuit of them that are willing to take, and I'll call ahead of time because sometimes some veg will produce a lot. And there's only so much pan squash and zucchini and tomatoes that they normally get. So I'll call ahead and say, hey, it's me again, that gal with that really productive garden. Can you take from me? And they'll say, you know what? We would love to, but could you call somebody else? And I'm not offended in the least bit. I'm like, sure, I can do that. But other times they'll say, yes, please just come. Because then what they don't use goes to a local pig farmer. And that feeds pigs, which then again feeds people. I love it. It's great.
Absolutely.
And then when we have an abundance, even when they're not willing to take, and friends and family are like, Megan, we can't store anymore. Please stop. I have a little produce stand that we put at the end of the road, and it's called the Dollar Stand. And it's take what you can, pay what you can, but things are roughly a buck. So like two cucumbers, throw me a buck. Whatever's out there, throw me a buck. I'll put flowers out there.
I love
and then they
that.
Know they can always, come up to the house and ask if they need other things. But that's always fun too.
That's cool. So a little bit of side money to help pay for some of the seeds and stuff too that you're having to buy every year.
Yes. That's the nice side, is that at least that covers my seeds for the following year. Then I'm good to go.
So I failed to mention how I met Meg. She is an OG follower of this podcast, and I had followed her back on Instagram way back when. One of the things that struck me about Meg's Instagram feed was the ever-constant presence of her dogs while she was in the garden, and they seemed to be eating just about anything they could get their mouths on, with permission, of course.
Let's talk about those dogs. The dogs that are—they're always out there and in the garden and whatever. What are their names?
Okay, so we've got Hunty. He's the baby. Hunt technically. He's a little fox red lab, and then we have Benz, who is a Catahoula blue tick coonhound mix. And both those boys will eat some produce. I tell you what, tomatoes, best thing in the world. They will sit and eat tomatoes. We had a dog previous to them who would steal tomatoes when I would harvest them. He'd just stick his head in through the fence and take tomatoes. But yep, the boys are there every time I'm down the garden harvesting, and they're usually between my legs with their head popping out, seeing if they can steal green beans or cucumbers or whatever else they can get. But they are garden dogs.
We had one dog that would park herself next to the green beans while I was in there picking, and she would help herself. She'd just choose one plant and she'd be picking the green beans off of them. And then I had another one. I had brought in a basket of peas and I had set them in the entryway and I went to go do something. I came back walking back in and there were shells of the peas laying on the ground. I'm going, okay, somebody's messing with me. Was it one of the boys? Were they in there? I was like, who? And they're, no, we didn't mess with the peas. I'm like, so I just left them sitting there and I went to sit in my office and I'm watching, and here one of my dogs came in and very gently reached in, pulled out a pea, sat down with it between her paws, peeled it open, ate the peas from inside, and then left the shell laying there and went back for another one. I could not believe it. If I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I would have never believed it.
What? But it's good for them. And hey, it cuts down on dog food cost. So it works for me.
Yeah. If they're willing to eat it, fine. They can have it too.
I think the dogs are on to something, by the way. There is something pretty spectacular about eating fresh vegetables right out of the garden that just doesn't compare to anything you can get in the grocery. I, for the longest time, could not stand fresh green beans from the grocery store. I thought they were limp and fuzzy. I had grown up on canned green beans, and what I got from the store was just not palatable to me. And then I started growing my own and choosing bush varieties that didn't have the fuzz or the string. And let me tell you, I will now happily munch on those green beans raw right off the plant while I'm picking them for market. Growing your own makes such a big difference.
What is your favorite vegetable, first of all, to grow in the garden? And then what is your favorite variety?
Oh, dang, this is a tough one. So, to be honest, I hated tomatoes. All my life growing up, hated tomatoes. I used to tell people they were poisonous if you ate them raw. I thought they were the grossest thing because the ones at the store are bland, they're mealy, they're not enjoyable. And then we grew a variety of, they're like smaller than a Roma, but bigger than a cherry, and it's called a shimmer tomato. Grew it because I thought they're pretty. They're supposed to have little gold on the outside, and we had a dog that loved tomatoes. So I was like, I'm gonna grow them for him. Changed my mind on tomatoes. So I would say tomatoes are my favorite thing to grow just because they come in every single color, every single shape, size, flavor. I'm really partial to the sweeter tomatoes. The low acidity ones are my jam. This last year we grew the big rainbows, I think, are my favorite because they're such a high yield tomato. But I also really like those accordions just because they're cute. They're so cute. They're huge, but they're really good. But you know, I'm kind of thinking my husband loves cucumbers, so we grow them every year. He loves the straight eights. Those are tried and true. But this last year I tried the Diva variety. Okay, I'm gonna say this word wrong. Parancarthic. That's the word where
Parthenocarpic.
they. Thank you. Oh my
Yes.
goodness sakes. Yep. I'm learning new garden words every year as part of my
Yay.
to-do list every year. That's one of those varieties that just doesn't need male flowers, female only, and it is a producer, I tell you what.
And
That
they are
if you're
so
looking
good.
for oh, they're the greatest. They're
Yes.
always like not bitter. You got the thin skins, little seeds, love those.
Yeah.
So a little bit more on parthenocarpy. Parthenocarpy is the development of fruit without fertilization. Now, this happens naturally in some plants, but in many cases now we've bred plants to do this for our benefit. The Diva variety of cucumbers Meg is referring to is one of those artificial cases. If you grow this or any parthenocarpic variety in isolation, meaning you don't grow any pollen-producing varieties near it, they can produce fruit that are seedless. This also reduces the chances of any bitter fruit. Now, these were originally developed for growing in protected culture settings like high tunnels, hoop houses, greenhouses, or wherever pollinating insects are limited or restricted. But home gardeners are also growing them now in outside settings to guarantee themselves a good yield and to reduce the bitterness we can sometimes get from things like cucumbers. Modern plant breeding is just so cool.
I think peppers, though, were my like, I won last year on peppers. I've never been able to grow a variety of bell pepper that turned color besides green.
It is so hard.
Oh, and in such a short season. And we did it
Yes.
last year for the very first time, and it was epic.
Ooh, do you remember what
Oh my
variety that
gosh.
was?
Oh, well, so the lilacs were great.
Oh, I
They
love
produced like
lilacs.
crazy. Oh, those are so good. The other ones, I've got them, I've saved the seed tags. Because that was, you know, lesson number one and garden number one. Save those because you're gonna forget. I always do.
So what other, you said that was one of your lessons was, you know, what your first year of gardening was to save the seed tags or the packets, or whatever. What other lessons did you learn along the way, failing forward, maybe the hard way?
Overcrowding. Overcrowding. Now, I will say, you did a podcast episode. Ooh, in the early days, where you talked about plant spacing and how it is smarter to have less plants, better spaced out, so you get a better yield from them than to have too many plants and get a less yield, lower everything. I don't remember what episode that was, but I was listening to that episode a long time ago and I was like, you know what? That is some smart words because I like to overcrowd and you always get less, but if you have less plants and you tend to them, you're always going to have a better yield, better plants, better everything. That is one of those that has stuck with me hardcore. That's one of those failing forwards for me.
I like that. It's such a fine line between having enough space for the plants, but then interplanting to where you're making a good use of the space. And I think one of the things that it's hard to learn is like, I mean, our lesson with that, I think I know exactly what episode you're talking about because I probably talked about the fact that we learned that lesson with growing tomatoes. It was, oh,
Yes.
we need 750 tomato plants because we're growing for all these people. But then you get to that point where now you're getting diminishing returns because you have too many plants and either you can't care for them properly or they don't have enough space or they're not getting enough nutrition. And so, great, you have 1,000 tomato plants, but they're producing as much as you did when you had 500. So why not just do the 500? But then realizing that even with those tomatoes, you still have room underneath and there's still space available for something else. It may not be more tomatoes, but it might be lettuces. It might be other leafy greens. It could be throwing some, you know, sweet alyssum seeds down there and having, you know, a nice little pretty white flower as a ground cover that's helping to choke out those weeds and cover. And at that point, are you sort of violating the spacing with those tomatoes? Maybe a little bit, but they're complementing each other. So I think that
is they're not choking each other out.
Yeah. And I think that's a really hard lesson to learn. And you know, you can listen to people talk about it all the time, but until you actually get out there in the garden and try it for yourself. And like you said, fail forward, figure out what worked and what didn't, and go, okay, well, that didn't work. Let's try something else. I don't think anybody should expect that they're going to go into the garden the first, second, third, fifth year and know exactly what's going to happen and how it's going to go and know everything. Yeah, you can't know everything. I don't know everything. I'm still learning. You know, and it's been 20 years, so like, guarantee I will learn something the hard way this year too. I always do.
Oh yes. Like staking my peppers. I should have staked them well before they flopped over and got woody and then, you know, trailing across the ground. I'm bending all the way over picking up peppers last year. I won't do that again.
But that means
I've got a plan for this year.
It means it was a good pepper year, though, because you had so much fruit that they were falling over. I mean, if they're not falling over, then you don't have enough peppers.
Oh, we did 200 pounds of peppers last year.
Wow.
I have the numbers next to me. So in jalapenos, we picked 518 jalapenos last year. I did cubanilla peppers. We got 176 of those, and we got 489 bell peppers.
That's amazing. I love that you have these notes. Can we just focus on that for 1 second? Because I think people don't pay attention, you know, enough attention to having a garden journal of some sort, even if it's just like taking sticky notes with you, you know, or a little notepad or something when you're in the garden and paying attention to what's the weather been doing to all of my plants? What are the bugs doing to my plants? What kind of weed pressure do I have? And what am I getting as far as a yield from each of these varieties? Because if you want to talk about learning as you go, there is no better way than to sit down at the end of the season or at the beginning of the next one and look at your notes and go, oh, okay, this worked, this didn't. What can we fix this year? So you guys are keeping track of your varieties and your yield. What else? What are you tracking?
I will take pictures when I see those dang pesty bugs that are going to be bad that I need to know. Okay, get prepared. You're going to be picking the potato beetles. I need to know when I'm going to start seeing them so that way I can prepare. I try and keep track of if we're getting too much rain. I mean, rain, I can't predict that. But I also like to know numbers on things. So like onions, how many specific onions did I get? That way it gives me a rough idea on planting for next year, the dates that we get everything. So I keep one of those little monthly calendars next to me and I make sure on the days that I'm harvesting, then I have a rough idea for next year when I should be expecting this variety, which means I'm gonna want a can. So then I have to look at my weekends and I can plan accordingly. I can call my best friend and say, hey, get your butt over here. I need to do canning. I need your help. But it gives me an ability to prepare.
That's brilliant. I love that. And I love, you know, the idea that you're taking pictures, because even if you don't have time to write something down, you always have the date that you took that picture when you go back and look at it. So you can say, okay, this was the first time that I saw these potato beetles in the garden. Next year, I know that I'm going to be ready. Or even for diseases, for us here, it's always the diseases in our tomatoes at the beginning of the year. We're very humid and it just happens that that's what happens. I mean, it's, and you know, at a certain point, it's going to rear its ugly head. So if you can be prepared the 2 weeks prior and use your copper spray, you know, to keep that, you know, that pest or that disease at bay, then the next year, you know, oh, okay, well, this is when I can spray that stuff and it will keep that, you know, virus or the disease or whatever from jumping into my tomatoes, but the pests too, knowing the life cycle. Yeah, exactly. It just prevents it from even, you know, getting there, and you don't lose the first half of your harvest because the plants are trying to battle, you know, an early blight or, you know, a fungal disease or something. And
exactly.
Knowing the life cycle of the pests that you're dealing with, like you said, knowing when they're going to show up, but also you can take that information and go, okay, we know that that is this pest. What's the life cycle of it? How is it getting here in the first place? Is it overwintering as an adult? Is it overwintering as a larva? Are they just laying their eggs and those are going dormant and that's what's hatching? And that way you can be better prepared as to how to battle them.
Meg is doing a really good job of doing all the things I preach, creating a garden plan, keeping a garden journal, detailing out the timeline of the garden when it comes to planting, harvesting, pests, and diseases. It's a big garden with a big harvest. How much time does all this take? It sounds like it could be really overwhelming.
For two people, you know, and a 1,400 square foot garden that produced 3,000 pounds of food. I'm just going to keep saying that over and over again, 3,000 pounds of food. What kind of a time commitment are we talking about every single week, again, in a short season for you guys?
So we both work from home, so I get to set my schedule. For the most part, I mean, I'll do a little bit here and a little bit there during the week. We're weekend warriors. I do the bulk of my work on the weekends, but it's just taking a bite out of it here and there. The biggest thing, okay, I know everyone loves their hula ho, so don't come for me, but you all need to Google what a skidger is. It is like a hula ho meets a sharp pointy, you can cut all those roots below the soil, not disturb anything, but it is like the best weed killer out there. I'm the chop and drop kind of method, except if you're purslane, then you get booted out of my garden.
Oh,
everything
I eat
else,
purslane.
Chop and drop.
I harvest
so
the purslane.
So many people tell
it.
Me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So many people just eat it. I'm like, but I plant lettuce for that.
Oh, it's so good. Do you know that purslane has the highest amount of omega-3 fatty acids of any land plant? Anything.
Are you serious? I've never heard of that.
I am absolutely serious. I actually will harvest it and sell it at the farmer's market stand. It is so good.
And people
that
are
stuff.
Buying it?
Yes. Oh, what? Yeah. There are people who know what it is. They're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you have purslane. Oh yeah, it's amazing. The first time I had it was actually at the cafe here for our botanical garden, Powell Gardens. And their little Terra cafe in there. They, you know, use stuff from all their different, they have a vegetable garden area and they were using stuff and they had purslane on there. And I had known purslane from like hanging baskets, like the cultivated type of purslane.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I'm like, wait, what? You know, oh yeah, you have to try it here. You can try it first before you choose to put it on your salad. And it was so good and so like succulenty and just, it was amazing. I was like, okay. And then I realized we have it growing wild. All over the place on the farm, and it gets in between some of the beds and it gets into my somehow magically into my raised planters. And yeah, I let it grow and let it do its thing. It doesn't ever seem to harm the other stuff. And if it starts to get in the way, I just zhuzh it out of the way and let it keep doing its thing. So yeah, eat that purslane.
What? He is the bane of my existence in the garden.
No.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. We are not friends right now.
Oh my
gosh.
That is
the one in, yeah,
because it will readily reroot. If you just chop it and drop it, it's going to just automatically reroot itself. So I get that. But so this is called a skidger?
Yeah. Skidger.
Okay, so I looked up the skidger, and it's a sort of heart-shaped tool that's twisted in on itself with a blade that is sharpened on the inside and the outside. So you can push it back and forth, and it will cut in both directions. You're doing a sort of push-pull motion, and the tool is cutting the weeds off at the ground level. I can see why it's so effective. It's also bent in a way that you can use it to dig out weeds or flip it over to make a furrow in the soil to plant into. It's on my wish list now. I'll leave a link in the show notes.
Yes.
Okay.
S-K-I-D-G-E-R. It is saved my time. I, you know, do everything by little sections here in the garden during the week. And I'll weed this area at lunch while the dogs are running. We're out. Or after work, I'll tackle, you know, half hour before I make dinner. Usually because I've got to go pick something for dinner. But I will, what would take me an hour takes me 15 minutes to weed. And when you stay on top of the weeds, they don't come back. So usually, you know, it takes me about a month to get all the weeds at bay for the most part. There's always maintenance weeding, and then it always slips over to you've got to start harvesting and canning and whatnot. But no, it helped me stay on top of all of my weeding chores that I was like a pro. I had very nice gardens this year, which was a first.
So the first part of the season, that's what you're focusing on, is just making sure that you're out there every day doing just a little bit of weeding while you're waiting for things to start coming in.
Yes, because I'm not very patient. That's the one thing the garden has been working very hard to teach me, is to just be patient. Things will come when they're ready. I can't rush everything. So it's nice to just kind of be out there and peep under the leaves. I'm like, you producing any flowers? You got any fruit for me yet? And yes, that is the name of the game.
Patience. So is it kind of an, you said your weekend word, is it all day, you know, all day Saturday, all day Sunday you guys are spending in the gardens?
It's mostly me during weeding time, which is, I find weeding peaceful. I love getting out there with a good podcast, obviously, and or good music, I jam, but just spending that time out there. But yeah, it's all work. Couple hours here and there, sometimes depending on if like there's a major weeding to be done or something like trellising tomatoes, that always takes time. And it's very relaxing to me. But yeah, we're weekend warriors, are in the evenings, couple hours here and there. Yeah, that's mainly what our summer looks like. Yeah. It gets me outside. I love it.
Yeah, for sure. And then once it's time to start the harvest, is it just fast and furious for the entire last like 6 weeks of your season?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then if people want to come over, I love it. But I warn them, I'm a feral wife in the wintertime or in the summertime, kind of in the wintertime, too. But in the summertime, my house isn't going to be perfect. There's going to be tubs of tomatoes everywhere. And if you want to have a sit down meal, it's going to have to be outside at a picnic table, because my house is my house full of veg that needs to be processed.
Yep. Nope. I absolutely hear you on that one. This house is a wreck. And then I spend, you know, try to spend the off season playing catch up, and I don't ever quite get there because I have 6,000 other things that I'm doing. Like, I don't know, a podcast and online courses and that kind of thing. But I had a fellow farmers market vendor who happens to be a dairy farmer. Their family is like the last dairy farm in our entire county. And so she's, you know, the quintessential farm wife. But they also, in addition to doing the dairy, she runs her bakery business and brings baked goods to the farmer's market. And one day she looked at me and she goes, "How do you keep your house during the growing season?" And I snort laughed and went, "I don't."
Not at all.
And she had this like sort of horrified look on her face. And then it kind of made her feel better, because she had been, and again, it's that sort of like previous generation's idea of farm wife was, hey, your job was to take care of the house and make sure the meals were on the table and bring field meals and all that kinds of stuff. And that has sort of evolved a little bit, especially when you're also the other half of the farm. Well, she was doing this bakery business like full time while her husband and boys were also doing the farm full time. It was like, I looked at her,
and she had kids.
Exactly. You know, and I'm like, and the grandkids were, she's a generation above me, older than me. And so her kids are like my age. And so she still had grandkids and stuff, and they all multi-generational farm. And I just kind of looked at her and was like, you know, I appreciate what the expectation used to be, but you are working full time doing this while the rest of the family is working full time during doing the farm. Why should it be your sole responsibility to make sure that the house is clean and the meals are on the table? And I, at first she was sort of taken aback by that. And then she stopped for a second. She went, "You know, you're right." I said, I don't think anything's going to change, you know, for you, but at least it lets some of the pressure off, you know? And so, yeah, I think it was just funny. I was like, I don't keep my house. There's no way.
No.
So it is
and
what it is.
In our season of, exactly, our season of life, we don't have kids. So I'm not chasing around anyone else. It's just me. I can plan my day how I see fit, and I enjoy it. There's going to come other times where that's not going to be the case, and I'm going to have to scale down the garden, and that's going to be fine too. But you got to give yourself grace. There's only so many hours in the day and only so much time you have.
Yeah, our kids are all grown and out of the house, and it's just the two of us now. And it's, I get to, yeah, I'm not worried about anybody else's activities or what anybody else is doing. I mean, I still pick up after my husband, like there's teenage boys in the house, but that's a whole different subject. But, but like you said, I'm on my schedule. We're on our schedule. We don't have anybody else's schedule we have to adhere to. And that also includes whether or not I choose to run the vacuum or not. So there's that.
Right.
Okay, so we have established that I am absolutely feral. Moving on.
But if somebody wants to kind of do what you're doing, where it's like, yeah, I'm going to grow enough for myself and my family for the year, but then I also want to grow enough to be able to give away and to bring to food pantries. Where should they start? You said you were a little overambitious that first, the first year or two. So what lessons can you share for people who want to try this?
My biggest thing is be to start small, start manageable. Because if you set yourself up for failure, you're not likely to do it again. You're not likely to try again. When you're successful, you're going to keep at it. So the biggest thing is to start small and plant a little extra. If you math it out and you're like, you know what, I use one onion a week, gonna need 52 onions. Well, try planting 60. Try planting just a little bit more, but start small. Be successful and then expand a little bit after that. That'd be my biggest advice.
I love that. Thank you for being here, Meg. If people want to see your gardens, they want to see the pictures of what you're doing and those handsome little doggy boys that are running around in the garden all the time, how can they find you?
Well, I'm over on the gram and just that. It's our Wisco Homestead. And yep, you're more than welcome to come ask questions, hang out, see what I'm up to. Usually, I'm in the garden.
Usually in the garden. I love that.
I will leave a link to Meg's Instagram account at Our Wisco Homestead in the show notes. In addition to the fabulous photos of her beautiful garden, she's got some great reels showing a lot of what she does with the goodness coming out of that garden, and of course, pictures of those puppy dogs too. I hope this talk with Meg inspired you to do something new in your garden this year, whether it's try a new variety or add a few more rows that you could donate to a food pantry or even just give away to a neighbor in need. There truly is nothing more powerful than food. Until next time, my gardening friends, keep on cultivating that dream garden, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Just Grow Something podcast. For more information about today's topic and to find all the ways you can get in touch with me or support the show, go to justgrowsomethingpodcast.com.
I have a problem with big, flashy tomatoes. I like them very big, very sweet, and very colorful. So right now, I haven't found a determinate variety that meets those criteria.
That's a good point. I like the really cool looking ones, and the bigger the better. You can like show off that giant tomato that like, your entire hand fills your entire hand. Yes.
Oh
So,
yeah, those accordion tomatoes. Oh yeah.
accordion tomatoes.
They're bright orange. They are ribbed, look like a little accordion, and all my neighbors are all farmers. So I give them tomatoes and they're like, this isn't a tomato. I'm like, it is. And they try it. They're like, this is the best tomato I've ever had. I'm like, well, I'll have them again next year.
Oh, I may have to add that to my list this year.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Accordion. I'm writing that down. All right.
Until next time, my gardening friends, keep learning and keep growing.